Hello, my name's Maurice McMillan and I'm one of the paediatric trainees based in Wessex. In today's episode of Fontanelle, we sit down with Dr. Alice Leahy, who's one of the paediatric rheumatology consultants based at Southampton Children's Hospital. And we're going to have a chat with her about lots of different subjects, including hypermobility and Ehlers-Danlos syndrome. I hope you find this episode helpful and interesting and spark some discussion amongst your peers. In the episode description, we'll include some resources that Alice highlights as some little extra further reading for you. Hope you enjoy. I'm here with Alice Leahy, one of the paediatric rheumatology consultants in Southampton. So thank you very much for joining us, Alice. So today we're going to discuss a whole spectrum of things, including hypermobility, Ehlers-Danlos, and it's something that's getting more and more press and getting more and more discussion surrounding it. So I was wondering if we could start with hypermobility maybe, and sort of your definition as you see it essentially, and how it might present to general paediatrics.
Yeah, so hypermobility, I think the first thing to say is that it's not a diagnosis, and I think a lot of people talk about having been diagnosed with hypermobility, or they come to clinic hoping to get a diagnosis of hypermobility. But because it's not a disease, it's not a marker of pathology. It isn't a diagnosis. It's just a description, and it's a description of somebody with flexible joints. So generally speaking, you're talking about a person who's got joints at the extreme end, if you like, of a normal spectrum of joint bendiness. So I'm quite keen when I meet with patients or other health professionals to kind of de-pathologize and de-medicalize the whole concept of hypermobility. And certainly when I was young and growing up, which is about a century and a half ago, but being bendy, I mean, the term hypermobility I think barely existed back then, but being bendy was certainly accepted as just part of the normal range, in the same way that having black hair or blonde hair were just the normal range, if you like. And actually, it tended to convey an advantage in many people. Athletes, dancers and other sports people are very often on the flexible end of the normal spectrum. So having said all that, there is no doubt that having hypermobile joints can predispose you to joint pain, and in some unfortunate individuals, subluxation as well. But it's not the common experience. So the majority of people with flexible joints have no problems with them at all, or at most kind of mild or self-limiting problems. So there are another group of people who have more severe symptoms, if you like, more debilitating symptoms or more widespread symptoms. And they may present to a paediatric clinic or orthopaedics or rheumatology, asking often for one of two things or both. And one is an explanation for their symptoms and or a diagnosis of Ehlers-Danlos syndrome or hypermobility syndrome, and there's an overlap there, or two, just actually wanting some help with this, some symptomatic help. And so I think the first thing we do is to try and tease out what it is that person wants or needs. Because you would expect that someone presenting in let's say, a paediatric clinic is presenting because of a symptom.
Yeah.
Or something that's bothering them or affecting their function. But surprisingly, that's not always the case. Sometimes we get completely healthy, functioning children, but whose parent is worried about the potential significance of the fact that they seem to be excessively bendy, or someone has told them that their child is hypermobile. And there's this belief now, I think, quite common, quite widespread belief, that that is something that needs to be diagnosed and somehow known about and managed as if in and of itself it is significant,
yeah,
whether or not you have symptoms.
And so, if we go back to the sort of symptom side of things, mm-hmm, of hypermobility, would it mainly be, if there are symptoms,
yeah,
it sounds like the minority of bendy children, only the minority would have symptoms, the majority,
yeah,
would just be bendy.
Exactly.
The symptoms that they might experience might include joint pain and
subluxation. Yeah, so the really typical ones that we see are knee pain, mm, and sort of anterior knee pain. And interestingly, hand pain when they write.
Okay.
So if you do have really flexible hands, then you are going to have to, the muscles of your hand are going to have to work much harder to keep your fingers in the right position, if you like, to, when you're gripping a pen.
Yeah.
Because the fingers tend to, if they're very flexible, bend away from the pen. You've got to work harder to grip that pen.
Mm.
So your muscles, which are being overworked, fatigue really quickly and start to ache. So it's really common that children will have, they do 10 or 15 minutes of handwriting and then their hand really hurts.
Mm.
So that and knee pain, I would say, are the commonest,
okay,
symptoms attributable to hypermobility. I should say that people may or may not have heard of the Biten score. So if you're actually trying to make a call, again, you see I'm hesitating to use the word diagnosis here, but if you're strictly trying to say if somebody is hypermobile or not, well, you can just take their word for it. You can just, they'll say, oh, well, I can put my feet behind my head or whatever it might be, or you might observe lax looking shoulders or whatever, or you could try and be a little bit more scientific,
yeah,
in inverted commas, and put a number to it, and that's where the Biten score comes into it.
Yeah.
However, it's not a score that I like or find particularly useful. I think it's very flawed. It wasn't validated in children.
Oh, was it not?
It was actually originally designed in a sub-Saharan African population of adults. So very much not applicable, generally. But it is important to know about it because patients and parents and families will probably know about it because,
yeah,
other health professionals may have applied it to them, or they may have read about it if they've gone and researched and sort of looked up about Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, etc. So I guess it's important to know about the Biten score, which is a 9-point score and looks at the degree of flexibility in knees, elbows, wrists, fingers and spine. But it's equally important if you are then getting into a discussion about whether somebody has Ehlers-Danlos syndrome or not, where actually there is a sort of a cut-off score, it's really important that you do it properly if you are going to do it.
Yeah.
Because it's, generally speaking, very poorly executed, very kind of, it's not done well, and so overcalling of hypermobility, I think, is the result. So there's a good reference. I don't know if you want me to give a reference now or put it in the end, but
we can include it in the explanation of the podcast.
Okay.
There's
a very nice paper, a classification of EDS, which has a very good explanation and diagrams of how to do it properly.
And we can provide a little link in our description.
Okay.
So that'd be perfect, because I think explaining how to do it on a podcast
is
maybe a bit
exactly,
of a challenge if
yes.
we're not a video podcast.
Yes.
Okay, so presentation-wise, you've got a varied approach in terms of some people that come with, I've heard about this, has my child got this?
Yep.
I've got joint pain or hand pain or knee pain, the classics.
Yeah.
So once, if you are suspecting that this, that a hypermobility issue might be contributing to a symptom, for
mm-hmm.
example,
mm-hmm.
is the best management usually with physiotherapist?
Yes, it is. Initially, it's going to be about reassurance, depending on what the question has been. So sometimes
yeah.
they're asking, is this arthritis or is there some
yeah.
other condition? Or, as we've discussed, is this EDS? And so a lot of my initial discussion might just be reassurance. And sometimes actually that's enough. They were really worried, but as long as it is not a condition, they're happy to get on with stuff. And with the really young children, that's usually all, because sort of formal physiotherapy is not usually particularly helpful in young children. Mm-hmm. But yeah, but yes, if there are ongoing sort of MSK symptoms that despite reassurance, etc., then some good physiotherapy can be really helpful.
Okay.
I think where it becomes harder and a more difficult conversation is when people have brought other symptoms as well as joint pain with a question about, is this linked?
So what sort of symptoms do you commonly find that parents or children themselves or young people themselves are worried about that might be linked if they're noted to be a bendy child, for example?
So often that will be things like dizziness. Mm. The child is dizzy when they stand up, or it might be bowel or bladder dysfunction, or it might be abdominal pains is a sort of classic one.
Okay. And in your approach to that, is it mainly just reassurance? Obviously, there are certain things that could be done, sort of lying, studying blood pressure, for example, for dizziness and checking for red flags for abdominal pain. But otherwise, I can imagine it's just more of a reassurance to the parents and the
yes,
patients.
I think generally what's underlying that query is a question of, can we link all this together with a diagnosis like Ehlers-Danlos syndrome?
Okay.
And usually that's what it is, or there may be a belief in hypermobility syndrome, which again is very similar. This is just really an issue about nomenclature at this point, and they're essentially talking about the same thing. And so I will, if the question is this all linked by EDS, then I will go through the Bighton score, I will look at the child's skin, look for any of the typical signs of EDS.
So for those of us that are perhaps less familiar with EDS, if I know it's on the rarest scale of diseases side of things, but what sort of things would you be looking for, to my sort of basic
okay.
knowledge, as so, joint hypermobility and skin stretchiness, for example?
Yeah, exactly. So the whole topic of EDS, so again, in the links at the end, there'll be this lovely reference paper, but EDS is a collection of collagen disorders. There used to be, I think, 6 or 7, but then in 2017, it was all in line with developments in genetics. There was a huge update and expansion of the EDS classifications, and I think there are now 13 subtypes of EDS. There are, of that 13, there are known genetic mutations in 12 of them.
Oh, okay.
And there are known histopathological changes in biopsy of collagen in 12 of them.
Okay.
The 13th one, which has neither a genetic mutation nor histological abnormality, is this so-called hypermobility type EDS.
Okay.
Which is part of the reason why there's a lot of controversy in sort of medical world, really, about the very existence of something called hypermobility EDS, and certainly controversy about whether it should be included at all in the classification. But that's another a debate for another day. But
that's a whole other podcast.
Exactly. So essentially, a lot of those 13 collagen disorders are extremely rare. So the three, if you like, to focus on and think about are vascular type EDS, classical type EDS, and hypermobility type EDS. And we prefer to use those terms now rather than using 1, 2, 3, etc.
Yeah.
Partly because the numbers have changed, but partly because it's so difficult to remember which one is which. And
more descriptive.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Vascular type you hardly need to worry about other than to know it exists. They usually present to genetics departments because there's been a family history of often something really catastrophic, like a sudden death or collapse due to some vascular rupture, or a bowel perforation, or sort of prolapsed organs. So sort of really awful stuff.
Mm.
So the index family member may have been tested, and then they're testing subsequent family members. So they don't usually present to paediatrics, or certainly to rheumatology, because although they do have joint hypermobility, it's not normally particularly troublesome. It's usually fingers and hands.
Mm-hmm.
And there are associated facies as well, sort of very thin skin, very obvious vessels, blood vessels, slightly similar appearance to a progeria, and a sort of a thin beaky nose and stuff. So I don't think those are going to come frequently to paediatrics. Classical type EDS, which again is rare, but not as rare as vascular type, these children are extremely hypermobile, so obvious that it would have been commented on by everybody. These are the children that you really can fold up backwards and feet behind head, and you know, you're not having to do a bite and score to say whether they've flopped through the door.
Yes.
They've got really excessively stretchy skin, and again, there are some lovely photographs of this, but they will be able to pull their skin out, let's say from their forearm, you know, the palmar surface of the forearm, 6 centimetres or something like that,
yes.
Whereas the, you know, upper range of normal is 2 centimetres or thereabout. These children, again, there's almost always a family history, it's an autosomal dominant, and they and often the parent that brings them in, are covered in bruises and weird scars, atrophic scars. They'll have bruises on their sort of foreheads because they keep bumping themselves. It's generally really obvious that, that they've got unusual collagen.
Mm.
And actually, again, these are not typically the children that are presenting to us with joint pain. They may have come from genetics as well. So that leaves the last group of hypermobility EDS. And then you're looking for a Bighton score of over 6 in prepubescent children and over 4 in postpubescent children.
As long as it's done correctly.
As long as it's done correctly. And actually just doing it correctly excludes an awful lot of self-diagnosed or health visitor diagnosed. And that's not, I'm not dissing health visitors, they do a fantastic job, but their expertise in doing Bighton scores is, you know, not that great. Why would it be? And then again, there are criteria to look at skin elasticity, which are beautifully explained. You need to find skin elasticity beyond a certain amount in 2 out of 3 different sites. So it's not just patient coming in, pulling at their neck skin, saying, look
at this. Yeah.
Exactly. So that's kind of EDS in a nutshell, really.
Okay. And, well, I suppose you could almost apply it to sort of safeguarding if you've got a young infant coming in with a known family history of diagnosed autosomal dominant EDS, then obviously that's definitely in play, especially with bruising in children.
It absolutely is. You're quite right about that. And actually, but this has been one of the reasons why there's been so much concern in the Royal College of Paediatrics and Child Health and BSPAR, the National Paediatric Rheumatology Body, about the looseness of the diagnosis of hypermobility type. The fact that it's a clinical diagnosis with actually quite, not exactly vague, but it's quite easy to over-diagnose, it's quite easy to self-diagnose.
Mm-hmm.
And when that is then used as a hypermobility type, which you can't disprove genetically or histologically, when that's then used to explain away signs which actually could be non-accidental injury, that's when it gets really dangerous. And that's where there are grave concerns about people making that diagnosis who are neither paediatricians nor have any expertise in safeguarding, in children's safeguarding, and that unfortunately does happen.
Mm.
And there are clinics where there's not a single paediatrician amongst the medical team there, but who are making that diagnosis, and that I think is very worrying, where it interfaces with safeguarding, and it absolutely has. You know, cases have been thrown out because somebody has said, no, the cause for all those bruises is hypermobility type EDS.
So I suppose that's the sort of scary side.
That is a concern, and that's been certainly been, letters have been written by the Royal College and BSPAR along those lines.
So. Okay, so if you're a sort of general paediatrician or a paediatrician in a smaller, for example, in a district general hospital, and you are suspicious of, okay, this seems like more than just hypermobility in terms of this is causing multiple symptoms, or even suspicious of something a little bit rarer like Ehlers-Danlos, would that would that warrant a referral to paediatric rheumatology, for example, or would you go down a genetics route?
I would go down a genetics route. I mean, I think that is the rarer situation.
Yeah.
I think those cases are going to be few and far between. But yes, if you get a whiff of this could be a classical type or a vascular type EDS, then I would be referring to genetics. They don't need to come to rheumatology. They may also need to be referred to physiotherapy if they're getting symptoms. Yeah. But as I say, often those children are not the ones that are particularly troubled by joint pain. They're often just getting on with it.
Yeah.
So I think that's going to be a smaller group. But yes, I would refer to genetics.
And for those that are struggling with joint pain, but there's no evidence of inflammatory arthropathy, the sort of important things to exclude, I would imagine, would be vascular problems, inflammatory arthropathy, that side of things, and you're going down the physiotherapy route, what sort of things would you say to sort of try and reassure patients and parents themselves? You could reassure that we don't think this is arthritis as such because of X, Y, and Z sort of thing.
So the key difference is pain, joint pain, is not a good indicator of inflammatory arthritis. So children with JIA very often have surprisingly little or no pain in their joints. And anyone who comes to a paediatric rheumatology clinic will testify to that, that they'll see lots of little kids, sort of 18 months old, trotting in with a flexed knee that they can't fully straighten, and a flexed elbow that they can't fully straighten because of active arthritis. But they are absolutely not in pain, and they want to play, and they'll let you examine them. And, you know, so obviously if you really squeezed it or really bent it, that would be sore. But pain is not what they're presenting with. So pain is not a good indicator. What we would see if the child had an inflammatory arthropathy would be swelling. We would feel heat when we touch the joint compared with the contralateral side or compared with the surrounding area. And we would see stiffness, or we would detect stiffness, so a loss of a range of movement. They can't fully extend that knee or elbow or fully flex. Without those signs, it's just joint pain.
Yeah.
And joint pain is usually much... joint pain on its own is almost always indicative of a mechanical problem rather than an inflammatory problem.
Yeah. And if these children presenting with joint pain and a query about hypermobility, I'm presuming investigations wise is very minimal in terms of if you're happy this isn't an inflammatory arthropathy.
Yeah.
I can imagine x-rays wouldn't be much help, blood tests wouldn't be much help.
No, I would agree with you. I do very few investigations. So if there was still, despite your clinical examination, if there was any doubt whether it was arthritis, inflammatory arthritis, and that can be the case, it's not always straightforward. It's easier in thin kids, but in kids who are not thin or in sort of chubby toddlers who've got nice chunky ankles and wrists, it can be difficult. So if you're still not quite sure, could it be, then don't bother with any blood tests. Just get an ultrasound scan, because that's a really good investigation.
Okay.
And a normal ultrasound scan will exclude inflammatory disease. I mean, so we scan everybody that comes into clinic. We do it ourselves, but that's the best test to get.
Yeah.
Blood tests are not helpful and will very often actually cause more problems than they solve. So the only caveat to that would be, obviously, if your investigation is targeted towards other things that you're worried about. You know, if you were worried about NAI, then yes, you might be getting x-rays.
Or yeah.
If you were worried about, I don't know, nutritional things, you might be getting bloods, but not if it's just a healthy, well child, is this arthritis or hypermobility, then no investigations apart from ultrasound.
Okay, brilliant. So I suppose, really, another reason I wanted to do this podcast is because of how much discussion there is at the moment in the press and the media and even like celebrity culture of Ehlers-Danlos syndrome. And why do you think that it's such a popular subject at the moment, would you say?
I think that's a really good question. My feeling, not just my feeling, but in rheumatology community, both adult and paediatric, is that Ehlers-Danlos syndrome is just the kind of latest in a long line of medical conditions that people have diagnosed themselves with. And I think And I think in the case of Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, I think social media has an enormous part to play in that as well. But going back a bit further, I think there have always been and always will be people with who perceive a lot of symptoms and have a lot of symptoms and are very tuned into their own bodily symptoms, which they desperately want an explanation for. And typically those symptoms are very subjective. So we are talking about joint pain, abdominal pain and bloating, headaches, dizziness, brain fog, all those kind of symptoms. And often on a background of or associated with anxiety. But
be that known or not.
Exactly. That is helping to perpetuate this. I'm not saying it's the sole cause of it, but who are seeking an explanation, quite understandably. And that over the years, those explanations have varied and kind of gone in and out of fashion, if you like. And ME, as it used to be known, or chronic fatigue syndrome, now was one. Chronic Lyme syndrome kind of became very popular one for sort of self-diagnosis. And Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, I think, is just the latest in that long line. I'm sure there were many before as well, if you go back through history. Neurasthenia actually is what it used to be called in the very old days. So it's often a diagnosis that there isn't a specific test for. It can't be disproved, if you like. There's no test that completely excludes it. And it seems to, if you read up about it online, it seems to fit exactly what your problems are, because it's all of those extremely common symptoms, all of which are made worse and perpetuated by anxiety. Social media, and as you said, the role of sort of celebrities, etc., I think is huge. So it's so easy now to just click on, I mean, if you just typed in to Google hypermobility, dizziness, joint pain, you'd straight away be on, the first thing that would come up would be Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, one of the patient groups, support group, and you will very quickly have diagnosed yourself as having it. And then there are great big supportive groups out there of other sufferers who will reinforce everything that you believe. And I think it is very easy to see why that is helpful to people and comforting to people who have probably in many cases done the rounds of medical professionals and got nowhere at all, actually, because it's the kind of thing, those symptoms are exactly the kind of thing that doctors really struggle with, because we can neither explain them nor fix them generally. So we quickly lose patients, we palm people off with often very unhelpful explanations. Where actually there's probably quite a complex biopsychosocial model for why that happens in some people. So I think probably some people have a genetic predisposition to getting a lot of pain, for example, and perceiving a lot of bodily symptoms that others wouldn't notice. So often, for example, we'll find that there's a child presenting to us with widespread musculoskeletal pain, but mum will come in and she's got fibromyalgia, which is sort of like the adult version of that, or somebody else has got some other chronic pain, or irritable bowel syndrome would be in another family member. So they're all linked. If you then add in some social, if you've got sort of major social issues going on or difficulties, also how do other family members respond to and behave when they have pain? Is there a very strong sort of medicalization or even catastrophization about medical symptoms in your family? And then other psychological factors, so anxiety certainly is a big player, poor sleep, all of these things kind of can create a perfect storm of symptoms. And then if you're in that situation, then of course you want an explanation, and ideally something that sounds really valid and medical, because nobody wants to say to their friends and neighbours, I've got this anxiety related something or other,
psychosocial
it's complicated. It sounds like it's all in your head, which is super unhelpful thing to say. Mm. It's really unsatisfactory. And so I can totally understand why people would rather find a neat medical sounding label to fit that. But unfortunately, that's just not what it is, and it's not actually ultimately helpful to label it thus either, because I don't think you then get the appropriate support that you need, which is going to be a mixture of physical, your physiotherapy, and or help with your anxiety, if that is playing a large part in it as well.
And I think us as professionals have to take some responsibility for that, in terms of, as you said, a lot of people get, in inverted commas, palmed off with things, and us taking responsibility to explain this model effectively and understandably to parents and to children themselves of, we're not saying you're making it up, we're not saying it's nothing, it's definitely something, it's something you're experiencing, and this is the background to this, and it's multiple factors rather than just... there is something wrong with this cell and this.
I quite agree with you, and I think that the mistake a lot of doctors make is that we think that by saying, great news, there's no arthritis, so that's not the cause for your pain, or great news, you don't have colitis, so that's not why you've got bellyache, or there's no brain tumour. So we think that that's the end of it, and that they're going to go off happy.
Yeah.
And that's not actually helpful to a lot of people at all, because they're like, well, that's fine, but I have still got these debilitating symptoms. So I think the key is very much to spend a lot of time listening to the patient's story, because they often don't feel listened to. They feel like they've been immediately dismissed because we haven't found a medical problem. So really, really listening to what their life is like, and then taking the time to explain the biopsychosocial, to absolutely, you're quite right to make an emphasis on the believing. It's super important to stress that I believe you. I believe that this is severe pain, and it is severe pain. It's exactly the same pain as you would have if there were damage or disease. Your brain thinks there is damage or disease, but there isn't. Mm. So it takes time, and I will often, if I sort of can predict from a referral or I know the patient from elsewhere, I will set aside a much longer appointment. You can't do this in a 20 minute or whatever it is. So I certainly feel for GPs, and I understand why they do refer a lot, because you just need someone who can take that time to explain. Yeah. And sometimes just the listening, the believing, and the reassuring can go a very long way towards actually a sort of therapeutic intervention, and then you will offer whatever else you think is needed, whether it's physiotherapy and or psychology.
Yeah.
Medical treatment's often not helpful, so people will have tried probably every medication under the sun. What I'm normally doing is actually taking people off things like codeine and stuff, which ultimately not helpful.
No. Especially not in children.
Exactly.
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 Okay. So I think we've covered quite a lot in a short space of time, I'm very aware. So we'll include references at the end of good resources to read around the subject.
I want to, you've just reminded me, can I just name check two books which I've just read, which I think every person in the world should read, but certainly every medical professional. So one is It's All in Your Head by Suzanne O'Sullivan. I think that's what it's called, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah.
Who's a neurologist. And the other one is called Head First by Alistair Santhouse, who's a psychiatrist. And both of them, I think, give a really fabulous explanation, really, about the connections between our mood, thoughts, feelings and emotions, and our physical sensations. So strongly recommend.
So we started on hypermobility, moved to Ellis Danlos and then got into this massive world as a topic all on itself. But thank you so much for joining us, Alice.
My
and
pleasure.
Thank you for imparting your wisdom.
Thank you so much to Dr. Alice Leahy and Dr. Marisa McMillan for your super helpful, wide-ranging and extremely relevant discussion around joint pain in children who may be hypermobile. It was really useful to be reminded that hypermobility is a description rather than a diagnosis.
It was also very good to review the 13 types of Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, three of which we really need to be familiar with. These are the very rare vascular type EDS, which Dr. Leahy explained would usually present to the genetics department. The classical type EDS, which is also rare, where you see an extremely hypermobile child with excessively stretchy skin that could be pulled out from the forearm to 6 centimetres. And this is autosomal dominant. And then the hypermobility type EDS. It was good to be directed to the resources, which I've put in the show notes, the 2017 International Classification of Ehlers-Danlos Syndrome, and then the RCPCH position statement on establishing a correct diagnosis of Ehlers-Danlos Syndrome hypermobility type. It was really interesting to hear Dr. Leahy and Marisa delve into why some children perceive pain differently, and to explore the factors that may feed into this, as well as why Ehlers-Danlos syndrome has become so prominent in the media and social media recently. The two books that Dr. Leahy recommends, I've put in the show notes. The first one, It's All In Your Head, I've read, and it is fascinating, and I will look forward to reading Head First as well. Finally, I'd just like to thank you so much for listening. It's been a long time since our last episode of Fontanelle. Marisa and I are extremely excited to be back on the airwaves and are planning some new episodes in the near future. But for now, from Fontanelle, goodbye.